Margaret Lovejoy, and this is called The Dancer Within. It's poetry that I've written over the span of 10 years, and it's a life journey, I think, when I look at it. Different phases of my life or what I see around me happening. The Dancer Within. Inside of me is a dancer, beating and tapping out the rhythm of life, moving slowly, swaying, twirling around and around, leaping, jumping, bounding, always trying to get higher, dancing for fun, dancing for sorrow, always trying to teach the dance. Please be my partner, come dance with me. Join in the beat. The beat is the sound of my heart, the in and out pushing of my lungs, the movement of my shoulders, the snapping of my fingers. The rhythm is my step, my gait, my bounce, my being. Inside of me is a dancer longing to be free. I'm not quite sure when I wrote that one. I know it's been around a while.
When I saw that one, when I saw your book for the first time a couple of days ago, I missed that detail in there. At least I wasn't aware of it, that you say, let me teach the dance. Is that how you want to teach it? That's interesting. Who do you feel you're addressing there? Do you feel that they would be younger people, older people? Would they be
young? A lot of times, I think with most of my poetry, I've been talking to women of like age, of myself, of like circumstances. Mm-hmm. It's hard going through life, but there are people there who will teach the dance, teach you how to get through, help you get through the hard times. You don't have to do it by yourself, but there's always someone there.
Yeah, right.
There's always someone there for me when I was having hard times.
If you have
or good times.
If you have an awareness of your audience, the listener, whatever, there, does that help you to write the poems? Do you always have that in all of yours?
Mm-hmm. The other thing, too, a lot of these were written because at some point I want them to go on stage.
You're what?
I want them to go on stage. I want it to be a performance.
Oh, I see.
And it's very much geared toward women and a stage setting. That's in my mind, at least. Different voices, different women with different voices. So sometimes they are quite different.
That would be interesting.
Yeah. The next one, again, this is kind of written all in that same period of probably 8 or 9 years ago, in that crisis time in life, when I was looking for something, probably looking for the God that I knew was in me, but had been battered and covered up, and I was always searching to get in there too. Because I really truly believe that God is inside, but sometimes the trappings of life are so that you can't really get down there to talk with God. And so I do it in a lot of different ways. Can you dance? Can you dance? Sure, I can dance. I can slow dance and fast dance. I can cha-cha-cha, just like on American Bandstand. No, can you dance my dance? And what do you mean, your dance? I can calypso swing into the monkey, I can waltz and foxtrot and go to South American tango too. I said, can you do my dance? It's a woman's dance, a dance to free your body, free your soul. It's a dance to believe in. It will make you hold your head up high and swing your womanly hips. The beat will be your life, giving meaning to the simplest task. Follow me and your life will be the dance. Have faith in me and the dance will guide you. This dance is about life. The dance is about woman's life. Movement, that's what it's about. Move to keep living, rhythmic moving to show you are alive, stomping feet to show you are angry, funny little steps for stillness, giant dance steps to show your boldness, wide-legged steps to show your full pregnant self. Waltzing feet to show your happiness. Take your sisters through the dance. Teach it, live it, be the dance. Let it live in you, be the dance. Keep it growing in you, for you are the dance.
I'm wondering if in that you might have been talking to yourself as much as to somebody outside.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, the dance is always capitalized, or should be, there's more that needs to be.
How long a period of time did that take you to make a poem like that? A couple of days, or weeks, or months, or what?
Instant.
How much?
Instant.
Really?
Yeah.
That's not your first draft of it. You made some changes.
But
you get the whole thing done?
When it comes out, it comes out in like
Are most of yours that way? Mm-hmm. Some of mine are, but most, I would say more than half are not. I fool around with them. But were you pregnant at the time?
No.
No? Just an image?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No. I find it when I write something and go back and fool with it. Especially if I go back a year or so later, because I've changed, I start to change, and then the whole meaning starts to change. So, and that's one of those funny things about publishing too, and giving it to someone, because it's there. Mm-hmm. And that's hard.
So if you do go back and look at it a year later, do you want to make a change? Is that what you're saying?
I try not to, unless it's really glaring and I look at it and say, oh yeah, that's not right.
Mm-hmm. So you don't mind doing that?
Yeah, but I try not to. I try to remember where I was at that time. And sometimes when I'm reading them, I change words around.
You do?
Because that doesn't sound just right. And add a little thing, subtract some words.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always in process.
What?
It's always in process.
Yeah.
This next couple of poems, well, this one I know for sure. These two that I'll read next come from some of my need to connect with my African ancestors.
You mean face to face or mentally?
No, just mentally, spiritually, to come in contact with them. You know, in the history books, we're about the same age, and the Africans were always seen in a negative light. Even though I was in a predominantly black parochial school, there weren't many positive things said about the African slave.
Is that right?
Yeah.
What were the teachers mostly nuns?
Yes.
Were
in
they?
Black.
Were they what?
In black.
They were?
Yeah. And all we really heard was that the slaves came over on ships and they didn't know how to speak. They didn't know anything. They were ignorant. And it becomes a time.
That's interesting.
It becomes a time of being quite ashamed of that part of me. And so, for the last year and a half, maybe 2 years, I've really been trying to connect with that African part of me. Number one, calling myself an African American rather than black or Negro or colored or a person of color, which are all these titles.
You went through all of those changes, didn't you?
All of those changes.
How much that like?
Well,
do you feel you're being manipulated at all?
It's like political. What's the political correct term to call yourself, rather than looking inside and saying, well, for myself, politically, I want to be this African American. I did consciously go to being a black person in the 70s.
Like the Negro.
The Negro. And on my birth certificate, there's colored. And my parents,
really? What state?
Minnesota. My parents would never use the word colored.
They didn't?
Always Negro.
Oh.
That was very important, that you were a Negro. When I made the conscious decision to become black and calling myself black, my parents could not understand that.
How old were you?
Oh,
high school?
Mid-20s. Yeah.
Oh.
And my children, you know, always told them they were black. My parents had a hard time with that.
you feel most comfortable now with Afro-American more than you did with Black when you were in your 20s.
Black was at its time.
Yeah,
it was,
and you felt as comfortable with that
time. It was a source of pride. You know, Black power came through, and it was this time to be proud of being Black. I had a huge Afro that went, shoulder
right?
to shoulder. I wasn't militant, uh-huh. but I was just in my style.
How typical were you of the people in your school, the other students?
How typical.
Were there others like you? That really had the same feelings you did about?
Well, you see, I chose to do this when I was married. So school, when I was in school, when we tried to blend in, teenagers try to blend in and be like the others. You don't want to stand apart.
It wasn't a revolutionary time for a number of you in the school,
no.
Were you already?
No, I came out in 61, so that was just on that time of mm-hmm. starting the civil rights marches, which I did participate in the early 60s, the marches on the counters, Woolworths and Grants had their counters, which in the South, Black people couldn't eat at. And so we in St. Paul boycotted the eating counters of Woolworths and Grants. In solidarity with our Black brothers and sisters in the southern states. Mm-hmm. So for that short period of time, I marched the picket line and did all that kind of stuff. But now it's looking at the African part of me. Because I think that's where my strongest spirituality is, in that African line, that bloodline. God was never anything in our family that wasn't. God always was. You knew that God existed. You knew that Jesus Christ lived. You knew all of these things. It was never questioned as I was growing up. And I grew up Catholic, and I turned Catholic.
And your parents weren't?
No, they were Methodist.
When you were 8 or 9?
I went to a Catholic school. Those nuns, they're charming.
Interesting.
They adored. But, so I'm going back to find that spiritual thread that I need to have. They're going to pick it up. And so, at some point in our lives, I would like to go to Africa and be there for a while. I have a girlfriend in Denmark who went to Kenya, and she says, I found your people. She's always commented on the fact that the space between my knee and my ankle, there's so much space there. And when we sit down together, her knee is here, and my knee is way up here. And she says, great, you get those long legs. So when she came back from Kenya, she says, I found your people. I know where you came from.
That's interesting. Because some of the people have been prime or the very best marathoners.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And with long legs.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm. Feel like you slight and long legs.
Mm-hmm. So then I did these couple of poems on Africa. And Mother Africa cries for all her lost daughters. Black, kinky-haired babies no longer born of her womb. Now brown babies fall from her swollen belly. Most are sold off to the highest bidder. Her love-filled breasts are used to nourish the master's babes. Her breasts sag, and she no longer cares who suckles. She cries for the love of Mother Africa. Scrubbing floors and cooking in someone else's kitchen with her hair tied in a greasy bandana, she keeps her eyes lowered so as not to seem uppity or out of place. And Mother Africa cries. Africa's daughter looks for beauty in Vogue and Cosmopolitan magazines. She sees blue eyes, silky hair, thin lips. The reflection in her mirror tells the story of her ancestors. She tries to mold her natural beauty to someone else's expectations. And Mother Africa's tears are ignored. Black power takes hold. She learns to appreciate what she has, that she is, and what she can be. Wrapped in the aura of Black presence, Lucy, her foremother, kindred spirit, family of origin, takes hold of her soul. She falls in love with all that has ever been, and Mother Africa smiles.
Mm.
So that's going through the history of.
It's a very good device, the Mother Africa thing, and detailing the behavior. Yeah. Would be interesting. Is that the school that you attend? Is that still active?
The grade school?
Yeah.
No?
No. I'm just thinking it'd be good for you to go back and read that.
Mm.
It'd be marvelous.
I ran into my eighth grade teacher several years ago.
A nun?
Yeah. We had a good conversation about what it was like to be a nun then, and the changes and the restrictions of being a nun then. And she didn't say it, but I know it must have been frustrating. She's a
really?
Very bright woman.
Yeah.
She now has her PhD in English, I believe. And to be a nun in the 40s and 50s, you were controlled. You had your place in the state.
Probably more if you were Afro-American than if you were white. But I had a sister who was a nun for probably 30 years. And I think it destroyed her. Well, I shouldn't say that. She's still somewhat healthy, but she got out in time, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It was too damaging.
Yeah, really.
She could see that. She waited until, well, my father had died. She knew that it was extremely important to my parents that she be a nun, that she stay in and see. But she didn't wait until my mother had died. Oh, my mom had a hard time. I wrote my mother a couple of letters to let her know that this was absolutely the right thing for her to do, and how she and Dad had all those glorious years of Tess being a nun and all the good that she had done, but it's time for her to make a move. But is this woman still in the She is,
but she has a completely different outlook on what it is to be a nun. She's out in the community, and she's changed. She stayed in the convent, but changed like some nuns do. They're no longer in the habit. They do community work. She's doing more of that. Let's see. What else, Ryan?
Go right down the
list. Yeah, some of them.
Does she have any bitterness?
She didn't seem to, because she changed. She was able to continue her education. She saw the positive side of that. The convent afforded her the luxury of getting her PhD, getting her the freedom to. She's editor of a small newsletter now, which she likes doing, and gives her a lot of freedom. I don't know if she'd stayed in the convent as a teacher, what would have happened to her if she hadn't been able to be strong enough to go beyond. Teaching, might have been a lot different for her. Well, I thought I had another, but it must be that other book, The One on Africa. That's what I want to do on that one. I guess this next set also is about being a black female. It's bronze woman sitting there calm and serene. Don't you know?
Can you hear that first word?
Bronze woman.
In the negative.
Sitting there calm and serene. Don't you know your belly's been scooped out? Don't you know your being is screaming for what has been taken from you? Bronze woman, still you sit there waiting for what is rightly yours to be put back. In your serenity, I can hear you. Without your head, I can feel your tears. Though your hands aren't moving, I can see your fury. yet still you sit there calm and serene, waiting for what is yours to be put back. This was a class that I took. I forget the title of it, but it was fiction class. And the sculptor came in, and we were supposed to write a story about this old teapot she had found, a bronze teapot, and she had incorporated that with a bronze figure of this woman. We had her mouth wide open in a scream. And everyone else in the class wrote a story about it, and I wrote a poem. I mean, that's when I kind of knew that I needed to be doing more poetry than
Did you write that now in that sitting?
It changed some in that I took the teapot out of it because that had no more meaning. You didn't have that figure in front of you, and the bronze woman on the teapot didn't mean anything. So that I took out. But still, there's this awesome figure of this woman with her mouth was huge, and it really was scooped out. That's what it looked like. Her arms were, I think, and you could see this hole in her belly. And it's how many women feel that this sacred place, this creative part of a female, sometimes does get just scooped out by creativity from just banging your head on the cement, gets pulled out. And you get very angry, but there's a place. Your place is not to show your anger. I was very much brought up not showing anger. Lord probably can't believe that now. But I was raised not to show anger. You didn't stomp your foot, you didn't slam doors, you didn't do anything.
In your family, you mean outside of the home?
In my family.
Could you show anger outside of the home?
There's like you were conditioned then not to show. Not to show.
I received the benefit of metamorphosis.
It's true, we do. I've changed. But there's no, that inside anger is out. When I'm angry now, it's out, I know it, and then I get on with life.
Why did this teacher bring this woman in?
It was her friend.
Oh.
It was her friend.
Were there only women in your writing program?
No. Brought in this piece, and there was another piece. There were two or three pieces that we could write on, and you were supposed to develop a story from them. You know, some people talked about the fact that it'd been a teapot, and then their grandmothers, and they had other kinds of stories about that teapot.
What response did your teacher have to this?
Well, she thought it was quite good.
Good?
Yeah.
Was it one of them made?
I think so. In order to get credit for the class, I think for that piece, I did have to write some kind of a piece of fiction along with this. And that's been lost in the shuffle of the idea for that piece.
Was this connected with one of the schools in
this? Metro State. Oh,
yeah.
This one, it should be titled, Have You Seen That Woman? Say, have you seen that woman, the one who used to cry all day? The one who had no future, the one who was left behind? You know that funny woman who slumped from chair to chair, the one with no dreams or visions and seemed never to care. Hey, have you seen that dowdy woman, the one with only one dress? She always wore a yellow and blue dress and faded red tennis shoes, her hair always a mess. She used to sit in that corner watching soaps most of the day, and then she'd go to the window just to see if there was a day. You know that lonely woman, the one that seemed to have no friends, no visitors. She used to have a family, but they grew up and left one day. That sad, sad woman, she died before she knew. She didn't have to sit out life. All she had to do was reach out her hand, and help would have been there. Again, women who are kind of shoved away into a corner that don't know that there's someone there to help.
Yeah. And there's good details in there. very appropriate.
Who kissed your brow today? Tell me this, black woman, what did you do today? Did you kiss that little child before he went to school today? Tell me this, black woman, did you hug that man today? Did you tell him how special he is before he left the house today? And tell me this, black woman, did you fix a huge fine meal to feed that growing family, to fill those round brown bellies before they went to bed tonight? But tell me this, black woman, who kissed your brow today? Who told you you're so special? Who thanked you for being here today? Again, the plight of the black woman not really being appreciated for her talents, for what she has, and that she gives all the time, but it's not either seen or appreciated. It really is seen a lot of time.
Do you see black women as being more unappreciated in their families than white?
I wouldn't use the word families, I would say in society.
Yeah, in society.
Yeah. I think, in families, I think they're supposed to be there. They become just a fixture that is there.
You get less freedom.
Probably so.
Probably so.
Because they don't have, a lot of freedom comes from financial gains. And black women don't have a lot of money power.
Mm-hmm.
And they suffer. They suffer. I think there's, a lot of families, they talk about the black woman being a matriarch. And those are some words. But in reality, I don't know. I don't know yet if those are really, if that's really true, that matriarch figure. I'm still working on that. Because I'm not sure that that's true.
I think it'd be so interesting to be in a group of listeners for you where you were reading these poems, and a mixed group, ethnically and ages and both sexes. And reading really just for women, maybe just for men.
I have read, I've done presentations of poetry, but not really a discussion. Usually it's getting out rather than discussion. And I think that would be good to do discussion. I think at a point now where in a process I need to discuss some of them and talk about them and get input.
Yeah. She's done two major presentations. One before going overseas and
one where?
One before going overseas and one in my home city.
In Minnesota?
Iowa, my hometown.
Oh.
Really, a lot of energy.
But they were not discussions, you said. They were an audience.
It was a presentation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you part of a program, or were you?
No.
You were alone?
Just me. Mm-hmm. And that's this collection.
I see.
This all got sent to the woman that retyped them for me. So this is the whole presentation.
There's a lot of interest after the presentation at my point. A lot of energy generated, it must have been, it kept you busy for probably about 45 minutes or an hour afterwards.
Does Metro use some guest speakers, that sort of thing? They must in some classes. Have you thought about going back there?
Just before I left, we were supposed to do a poetry read, but they were going to bring in five or six people to read their poetry and ask me. I had said that I was interested in doing it, but it was a time when I was leaving Metro, coming here, mm-hmm. So I couldn't do that.
How about at the law? Have you ever been interested in that?
I haven't pursued the law. Taken some classes there.
You did, yeah.
Metro and the Loft, they share instructors and classes. So I have taken classes there, but I've never done any reading there. sister friend, again, showing unity with my women and sisters and friends. We've got it all in us, my woman sister friend. We've got the power to be just what we want to be. Come along, my woman sister friends. Let's stay together to show them how powerful we can really be. We've got it in soft over footprints of other women and sisters and friends. But that's the reason they made the path, so we could find the way. Don't be afraid. We've got it together, my woman sister friend. No one can stop us now.
Mm. Have you thought of ever having somebody put some of these to music? You're not interested in anything
about them? I've thought of some of that too.
Yeah. Some of the rhythms that you've got there, the repetition, and that just reminded me that maybe somebody would be singing these.
Yeah. There are some that I think in when I wrote them, I don't know the tunes in my head. I think I have some that, you know, there's some kind of a tune. Or I'll hear a tune and I'll start writing words that would fit in that tune. Mm. Especially
some of these?
No. The drums that we had here this earlier in the summer.
I heard them once over at the service in the evening, somebody would play drums.
Yeah. I like the sound of the drums.
I want to hear that in the beginning. Are you going to read that?
Sure.
I have to go see Mary Hubbard.
Yeah.
Who is that?
Okay. He wrote the Vespers. It's here.
The Vespers.
Oh. He's not here.
No. In the beginning, in the middle, in the end. An assistant in the crowd, in the no, in the bank, in the red, in the green, in the black. Insufficient, in debt, inept, in gratitude, in power, in house, in here. In the beginning, in the middle, in the end. In love, in tune, in form, in tears, in silence, in rage, in keeping, in firm, in tear, in war, in peace, in season. In the beginning, in the middle, in the end. In kind, in God, in keeping, in prayer, in church, in death, in memory. In the beginning, in the middle, in the end, in the end.
Yeah, now that would be interesting to see what a drum would do with that.
Mm.
I mean, that's got such strong rhythm, and it moves so quickly that sometimes, you know, music can take over a poem and destroy it, but I don't think it could do to this one because the phrases are quick and you can readily understand them. You ought to practice reading with the drums. So do you drum on either one of you? No?
No.
Huh.
This one I like, the one with curfew.
Oh, yeah.
Peekaboo, I see you. Pancake, pancake. Happy birthday to you. No, I can't show you how to play football. Stay out of the street, you and that biker gonna get grounded. Be home at 8 o'clock. 9 o'clock, 10, 10:30, 11:30. Be home by 1. Be careful. I love you.
Mm-hmm. That's so graphic.
Yeah, what started that?
Just watching my kids grow up.
Yeah?
Oh.
Looking at them and seeing, you know, my son, you know, the first thing he started doing with him was peekaboo and playing.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Then they go through that, that aging, progressing, and
yeah. There's
so many things that you live through with your child, and in the end, what can you do but love them?
Yeah, that's a very succinct capitalization of the process there.
Make September song seem like an instant.
Yeah.
Listen to it about the kids. He grew tall much too soon. She grew graceful before my eyes. Our time together wasn't a long, sweet story, but pieces. Never enough time, bits and pieces of conversation, usually while I cooked. Karate practice, baseball gloves, eye makeup, new shoes, Christmas lists, college choices, part-time jobs. The intense look of a young boy trying to ride a bike. but I can't remember the actual day he pedaled away. She loved people and lots of friends was important. Did they like tomato soup or parades, trips to the zoo, going to grandma's? Now he's tall and strong and kind and gentle. She's caring and bright and always ready for an adventure. I want a video of their lives, and on quiet evenings I will replay it because the years passed too quickly. Again, those kids grow up.
Yeah, you can really feel that one. Do your children ever let you read to them? They do now.
The fiction that I write, Annie likes to read it as it comes off the press, so to speak. And she'll sit there with me as Roy will and read the first draft. And I guess they keep wondering, when's the next one coming? I was doing pretty good. I was on a roll this spring with a book I'm trying to put together. With the process of moving and coming here, you can't do everything yourself.
We need to go to the Lake Country of Denmark.
Oh,
that. Where are we at then?
Or you were there?
To the Tokyo?
We went there for 3 weeks before we came out here.
Where?
Lake Country. Where were we?
Sokolov?
Sokolov. Never been to Denmark. I don't know, so she could write.
Were you able to write there?
The first time I went to Denmark, and I was there for 3 months, I was able to write there.
You've been there seven times?
Yeah, twice. And I put together some stories there and some poetry, which is none of it's in here, come to think of it.
Why did you choose Denmark? You didn't have somebody there?
I was with a study program.
Oh.
Through the University of Minnesota. Uh-huh. And I was writing a paper on Danish women and their issues. And social service agencies that are available to Danish women. Huge paper, I never finished it. One of these days, if I'm doing it for a master's, I'll finish it for a master's program.
Do you have some kind of a model, the Denmark, that is worth?
Well, you know, you always hear that they are so much more progressive in their social service system. And that was part of what I wanted to see, if they were more progressive.
What did you discover?
I don't think so. No. I think they have, you know, their medical, of course, is much more superior than ours. But there are things that fall by the wayside, which is mental health, that their socialized medical system does not pay for mental health. Mm-hmm. If you need a psychologist or a psychiatrist, you have to pay for that yourself. Mm-hmm. And of course, again, women are the ones who are more on the lower economical scale and in need of mental health programs, and they're not as strong as I think they could be. And mental health is incorporated in the service that the U.S. has, if you have medical coverage, but there you have the medical coverage for mental health. And while I was there in 89, they just passed a bill which allowed the police to take the abusive husband or spouse or mate or whatever to jail before they would just remove that person from the house and drive them a few blocks out.
Oh my gosh.
No, there was no laws that say if you are an abusive toward a person, you can be taken to jail in a domestic situation. Mm-hmm. And so that was in 1989, and we've had thousands of abuse, and we've had the ability to put men in jail for abuse for a lot of years.
Had they tried to get that legislation earlier, do you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you were there the year it passed. Mm-hmm.
And I was in a women's shelter. I stayed in a women's shelter for about 2 or 3 days. And that was one of the big things, that now abusive mates could be jailed. And they had a way of protecting
a better way of protecting women.
What were the ages of the women at the shelter? All ages?
Yeah.
Even into their 60s?
There weren't, when I was there, I could stay because there were only three or four women there at that time. Mm-hmm. When they had room. And there was a Turkish woman who had been in Denmark for years, 10, 12 years, who still could not speak Danish. Her husband would not allow her to learn Danish.
Wow.
So at the shelter, she'd been there for a couple of months, and they were teaching her how to speak Danish, how to use money. She worked. She did day's work, and her husband would drop her off to do his house cleaning, and he would come and pick her up. And the person in charge, whoever that was, would tell the husband what they wanted the woman to do that day, and he would tell her what she had to do for work in this house. And then he'd come back and get her. So she never learned English, she never learned how to use money, she never learned how to shop, nothing like that.
He was a Dane.
No, he was Turkish. Turkish. She was kept in the home. And then there was a woman probably about my age who they said was a frequent visitor of the place. She was in a relationship that was very abusive, and she couldn't take anymore. She'd come to the shelter with her son, who at that time was about 12, 13. Mm. And then there was a younger woman. She was, in her 20s. And she'd been in an abusive situation, relationship. So it was really interesting. Staying in a shelter, I mean, I had never stayed in a shelter in the U.S. and we'd go into Denmark.
And you were there as part of your study?
Yes. Yeah. But it was a good program. I was there for 3 months. And
You could write there and you wrote up at the cabin?
Yeah, we write at home too.
And you write at home when you have an opportunity.
When you have an opportunity. Sometimes life doesn't afford me opportunities for.
Somewhere there's a place you can write.
A cabin in Denmark you were
in? No, in northern Minnesota.
Oh, where?
By Pleasant.
That's way up there.
Well, it's what, 40 miles?
Three hours north of the city and 45 minutes west of the loop. Off a hidden half notch. Not living in Indonesia.
Let's see, this one I like. Gift from Santa. When I was a little girl, my world was my walk. Wrong one. Gift from Santa. Gray wagon, gift from Santa. Daddy, are you sure it's mine? Little girls don't have wagons. Gray wagon, with Greyhound printed on the side. Special little girls get wagons. But are you sure it's for me? What can I do with it? How can dolls be a part of a wagon's life? Stash it in the basement, perhaps for a year or two. Funny gift from Santa. Maybe he thought I was a boy. Grade school paper sale, sure wish we had a wagon. Taken out of storage, looking like brand new. Gray wagon, gift from Santa, with Greyhound printed on the side. It works well pulling papers. What else can it do? Maybe it can be a friend, even though little girls don't have wagons. Steel gray wagon, with Greyhound printed on the side. Let's make a fancy playhouse. Eleanor's got some wood. That wagon pull that lumber, maybe 4 blocks or more. Wonderful gray wagon, best toy a girl can have. Wagon train, cowboys, and Indians. Circle the wagons, mine was the best.
Doll parades, boats to be made, scrub and polish, decorate with bows and rings. Greyhound wagon, special friend of mine. How could Santa know I needed such a special gift? Greyhound wagon, such a special gift.
I didn't read that one when I went through that. I missed it. That's good. The transition that takes place. Yeah. That's good. And how did that get started?
Oh, just childhood memories. Section of a time when I went back to looking at what did my childhood mean and what was important in my childhood, and hearing people so often talking about the negative parts of their childhood. You know, their parents were too stern and they didn't have this and they couldn't do this or whatever. And I know I was very blessed to have. And we have good parents. Things that if I look back, and you know, I raised my children a little different than my parents raised me, but they were absolutely truly loving, and you always received unconditional love no matter what you were doing. They might not like the act at that time, but you knew that you were always, always a loved child. And talking to people about childhood, I found that many people didn't experience that.
Right.
They were loved as long as they were doing what they were supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. One of the best things my mother ever said to me when I went through divorce was that no one in our family had ever been through a divorce, and she didn't know what to do for me or how to help me, but that I had to let her know what I needed. And coming from, you know, that age group where divorce was really looked down upon, having her say that she was supporting me through this divorce was very meaningful for me. And they were always there for me. They were all we knew.
Did she know that this was coming up long before?
No. I had the idyllic marriage on the outside. It looked wonderful. You know, the storybook, the house and the car and all this. It was wonderful.
It was an idyllic era.
Yes, it was. Era. And no one talked about the problems.
Mm-hmm.
And when it got to a point where I couldn't take it anymore and was just so depressed and despondent and everything else and ended up in the hospital, then they knew that this marriage was not good.
Did somebody else come or did you?
Only when you're in the hospital with depression that you're in.
Oh.
You kind of figure that out.
Mm-hmm. You have brothers and sisters?
Mm-hmm. And going through all the turmoil, there's only one person I ever told that this was so awful. It's my next one.
Really?
I was good. I mean, you didn't talk about your stuff. You didn't.
Yeah.
That was just, you know,
I was the 70s. All the time. You can't hear.
I was the 70s. And I was on that cusp of being 49 now, being born in 43. I'm not a baby boom child. I'm a war baby and not a pre-war baby. So it really puts you on that fence, and if you're after the war baby, when birth control came through, there was no question, you just did it. But pre-war baby, you didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
But a war baby, you had to make a choice, you had to make a decision. And it's that way I find with a lot of the social issues. And I've talked to women, and they feel the same way, that those of us born during the war, 40 to 44, during the war, 45, we have to make a decision as to where we're going to be, pre-war or post-war.
Mm, I never heard that.
In that, in the social strata. And so I guess in talking about my situation at that point, I chose to be pre-war, and I'm silent on the inside and kept a smile on my face and everything's just fine, you know, we'll get through this. Then when I found out, I'm not going to get through this, then of course I changed over. I wouldn't have some rights, I don't have to stay in this marriage, I don't have to be abused. And he was not physically abused, he was mentally abused.
Mm-hmm.
And made that decision, I don't have to stay in this.
Did any of your friends reject you, but were they silently or were they critical about you?
Well, you know, and those divorced people, they're such an albatross for everybody. You don't know what to do with them, you know, there's no place at the table for them because you're supposed to be the payer.
Oh, yeah.
So you have a dinner party, you know, a divorced person, where do you put them?
Huh.
So you don't get invited there, and parties you become a threat to other women because here it is, this loose woman. And then being invited to the parties, and so yeah, it was a change. It was a change.
Sure.
But the next change that happened was, so many of my friends, after I divorced, started divorcing. And then they would come to me for guidance as to...
Is that right?
Yeah.
Ah.
Wow.
How did you feel about that? Did you feel comfortable talking with them? And knowing that you might be influencing them?
Well, you support them.
Uh-huh.
You support them. And you listen to them. And... what I did eventually was, 8 years ago, I came here because so many people were coming to me for support, and
you came up here to Hoover.
Yeah, I got real burned out, and people didn't come to see how I was doing. They come to
stuff.
And when I said that I was leaving,
escaped.
When I was leaving town, is one woman accused me of running away on her, that the only reason I was leaving was that.
How long a time did you come here the first time?
4 years. 4 years, yeah.
Huh. How did you know about Holden?
A person I worked with.
Oh.
Had been up here. We're almost out of time. I'm going to read this last one, so it's on tape, so I can hear what it sounds like on tape. Like I said, this was the first poem I wrote 10 years ago. On the eve of my 39th birthday, when I felt like I had come through a lot of stuff and had gotten through it. And it's praise me. Praise me. Yes, praise me. But don't praise me for doing what I had to do. Don't praise me for things I had no control over. Praise me for now I can walk without asking permission. Praise me because now I know I am now selfish, self-centered, out to take care of me. I am no longer the person who can take care of the world. I've added a prefix to the tape women are implanted with at birth. The tape that says, be loving, caring, giving, unselfish. Well, I'll be all those things, but first I must do those things for me. Right now, I'm in the middle of doing it for me. If I don't do it for me first, I'll never be able to do it for anyone. Praise me for that. Praise me for knowing where I am today, not where I was or where I may be next year. But praise me right now for this minute. Praise me for living this minute. For too long, I've dwelled on the past and dreamed of the future. And for God's sake, don't praise me for how I look or what I wear. But praise me because my eyes are smiling and full of light. Praise me for raising my children lovingly, willingly, and with discipline. Praise me because I can just as easily tell my children to wash out their own underwear as I can tell them I love you and I'm so proud of you or you are so special to me. Praise me for not being a superwoman, for admitting I never was, am, or will be a superwoman. Praise me for now I can relax. I no longer strive for perfection or super greatness. Now I can devote my time to being me.
I'll give myself the time to discover the real me. Praise me for making decisions without consulting everyone I know. I will seek counsel, but then I'll do what I think best. I'll make a decision, be it right or not right. The praise is not for the actual decision, but my newfound ability to make decisions. I'm standing before you with my head held high and my shoulders squared, my chest poked out, demanding your praise because I want it, I need it, I deserve it. That's where I am. That's the stage I'm in. Praise me for it. Praise me because I'm doing all this for me, and I'm doing it without feeling guilty or angry. And I am so proud of you. Praise me for that.
It's a very healthy poem. Did it have an effect on you, writing it? Did it help to persuade you that there was that worth and that merit?
Yeah. It was not only the writing of it, but then it was sharing it with another person and another, and getting to a point of saying, I'm okay. Mm-hmm. I can ask for what I want. And I can tell my kids, they can only say two things to you, yes or no, neither of which will kill you.
That's good. Why do you put that one at the end?
I don't know. It's just always ended up at the end.
It's a good place for it. I just wondered.
Yeah. It just seems to be the place to end what I do when I'm doing these.